Tour of Duty will return next week at its regular time.
Let's go have some fun.
Now, stay tuned for the CBS special movie presentation of Aliens.
It looks like a real hot dog to me.
She's the new live-in nanny from the Australian Outback. He's a kid from New Jersey. Throughout tonight's shows, find out more about them in previews of Live-In. CBS special movie. This year, she's the only actress nominated for two Academy Awards. Riveting in a role that dominates the screen.
Each one of these things comes from an egg. So who's laying these eggs?
Sigourney Weaver stars in a network premiere that will push you to the outer edge. A film that will make you glad.
Get away from her, you.
She's one of us. Aliens. Next.
Podcast Dark Horse Presents Aliens. Deactivating language censorship. Warning, spoilers activated. Engaging.
So this is Paquita Trotamundos, my longtime partner and first guest host on the Aliens podcast. Can you tell folks who I am and tell them some of my favorite movies?
Hello, guys. Like Frank said, this is Paquita, Pulp Fiction, Heathers, When Harry Met Sally, and The Fountain, Aliens.
Probably my first favorite movies were the Star Wars trilogy, and at the time, particularly Return of the Jedi. Superman, the motion picture, which I saw theatrically. I didn't see Superman 2, so it didn't have the same impact. And I really enjoyed the first two Indiana Jones movies, particularly Raiders of the Lost Ark. But I was so excited in the summer of 1986 by the trailers to see Aliens without ever having seen the movie Alien. And having seen it, it just completely blew my mind and became my favorite movie for quite a few years.
One would think after the extraordinary critical and commercial success of the Alien comic book adaptation that heavy metal would be chomping at the bit to do the sequel. Perhaps heavy metal was a victim of its own early success given the poor response to its follow-up movie adaptations. Further, Marvel Comics specifically, it had a lack of success with a lot of its movie adaptations, and the taste for R-rated material seems to have subsided going into the 1980s. Both Marvel and DC were chasing after toy licenses at that point. That's where the money seemed to be. And it probably didn't help that the Alien sequel was rather late. You're looking at a 7-year gap between the first and second films, and this is a sequel to a horror movie, somewhat troubled production. So I can see where there might be some cynicism about the response to Aliens. And in fact, the only full adaptation of the movie that's ever been produced for comics was an unlicensed one out of Hungary titled A Boligo Neve Halal, translated as The Planet's Name Death, which was the Hungarian title for Aliens, per Xenopedia. A few pages of this version are available online. I personally don't mind the art. It actually reminds me a little bit of Al Williamson, as I was talking about last episode. It's not obviously up to his quality. It is black and white. It looks to be smaller dimensions, and it has that sort of Silver Age stiffness of, say, like a Dick Ayers. But tonally, it seems to match fairly nice, and I'm just glad that somebody at least made the attempt. There was, however, a quasi-adaptation done rather late in the game, 1992 specifically. This was a 2-issue, square-bound, prestige format, fair, $4.95 per issue, titled Newt's Tale. It was sold as the story of aliens as told from the perspective of the young girl who is a quasi-protagonist and motivation for the heroine Ripley throughout the movie. It's credited to Mike Richardson, the publisher of Dark Horse Comics, penciled by Jim Somerville. Somerville had done the original Walking Dead comics, not the ones that are famous, not the ones that became a television show, but a 4-issue miniseries published by Air Cell. Zombie Tale for Gore Hounds probably owed a lot more to Romero or O'Bannon. That would have been the time frame. That miniseries featured an early cover by Del Keone, and it's difficult to come by. I've always wanted to read it. I never have personally, and I'm a big zombie fan, so I'd probably probably be up my alley. What I had picked up instead was three of the four issues of a semi-sequel called Dead Walkers, which was a curious thing. It was about trying to mate living women with zombies and whether or not that was possible. And it had a scruffy anti-hero in a trench coat and really a bit of nonsense, which is probably why I didn't keep my copies. I'm curious to reread it, but unfortunately, if you go on eBay, trying to put together a set would run somewhere around $90. There is a decent deal on right now for the Walking Dead four-issue miniseries in the realm of $50, but I'll be honest with you, based on the artwork that I'm seeing in Newt's Tale, while definitely stronger than what was in Dead Walkers, not a huge draw for me, to be honest. The inker was Brian Garvey. Probably the most memorable parts, though, were the two covers produced by John Bolton. There is a notation on the inside front cover that the book is based on the screenplay by James Cameron. I feel like that's misleading. This miniseries was essentially written by James Cameron. It is probably about 70 to 80% directly derived word for word from the script. The only real adaptation was in the panel-to-panel layout of how that was being reproduced. And typically on adaptations like this, you would put top billing to the original story and screenwriter. So I think it's rather disingenuous of Mike Richardson to try to claim credit for actually writing this. There's a small portion that I think that he deserves credit for.
Can you tell folks the basic plot of the movie Aliens?
It is a sequel, obviously, of Alien, where the main character, Ripley, comes back out of the experience of what happened on the first movie. Comes back, she's in a facility, I think it's back on Earth, and she finally wakes up after the issues. And they're telling her that they have to go back. They need to recruit her to give her more information about this aliens, because they used to have a colony, and a lot of people start disappearing. They start receiving messages back. They suspect it has something to do with what she fought, or they still don't know exactly what is happening. So they try to recruit her as a consultant. So she accepts after a lot of digging around, because it's like she doesn't want to do it. She doesn't want to deal with those people anymore.
There's a fellow who works for the company Weyland-Yutani named Carter Burke that's the main person that's helping her get reacclimated to things on Earth, and is also the motivating force to get her to go back to the planet where they first found the aliens.
What was the motivating force? I don't remember that.
They lost contact with terraforming colony known as Hadley's Hope, and because they don't know why they've lost contact, and because they lost contact after she told them about the aliens, if there are aliens present, they want somebody on the ground who knows what they are.
So the main purpose of her coming back is because she knows they're aliens and she knows how to fight it?
She's the only one who's ever encountered those particular types of aliens.
So that's how she finally decides. See, I don't remember those.
She's having nightmares, and she's in a dead-end job, and she basically realizes that she has to confront these aliens again to move forward with her life.
Gotcha. So yeah, so they finally go over there, and they have this group of soldiers. Typical, I guess you're gonna say, army disposable people.
They're colonial marines are set up as being the guys who can take on these aliens. They've had interactions with other alien races, and they're not afraid of any bugs, but they don't know what they're in for, obviously, since they're going up against the killing machine.
One of the main ones that I really like the character in that movie, I think that's one of the main reasons why I like the movie, Vasquez. She's like the only female marine in there, and
she's not the only female, but she's the most prominent and the most aggressive.
She's the only female?
There are other women.
That proves my point. It's the person that stands out the most, even among the guys. I know, like,
she's not the memorable female character. She's a memorable character, period.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So they go inside, and within, I think, the first encounter, they get all massacred. They got really fucked up.
Let me pause for a moment. We're talking about the comic book adaptation, and one of the odd things about it is that everything that you just talked about, for the most part, aside from the massacre of the Colonial Marines, isn't in this comic adaptation.
Now, let me ask you something. Is this comic adaptation is the one comic for the entire Aliens, or they start with Alien and then go Aliens?
Yeah. It begins at the point of a deleted scene that isn't in the theatrical release of the movie that was put back into the movie for the director's cut. And the story, as told in the comic book, is supposed to be from the perspective of the character of Newt, who you missed talking about when you were giving your rundown. What can you tell me about Newt?
Newt, that's the little girl, right?
Right, but they found her before they find the aliens.
Yes, that's right.
The book opens on a nice splash page of deep space with some cool cosmic swirls and a tiny little ship in the far distance. As we get closer, we realize this is the Sulaco, the ship that transported the Colonial Marines to the infamous LV-426 from the original Alien movie. And then we see a shot of the young child child Newt in cryosleep following the events of the Aliens movie. From there, we flash back to the planet Acheron, and specifically the colony Hadley's Hope, population 159 according to the comic book. And from there, it picks up with a deleted scene that was reinserted into the movie for the CBS broadcast of the film. It's a rather profane and violent movie, and so when CBS broadcast in 89, to make up for all the material they cut out of the film, they put in a lot of these deleted scenes that were intended by Cameron to be in the theatrical release, but the cuts were forced by 20th Century Fox to bring down the runtime to get more viewings of the movie per day in movie theaters. And also, apparently, executives felt like a lot of these sequences were a whole lot of nothing, taking up space. In some cases, I could see where they might have a point about it having an adverse effect on the pacing, but some of the sequences are more essential. However, in 1991, a Laserdisc was commissioned to put in not only the scenes that were on the CBS broadcast, but a number of other sequences that Cameron wanted in the film, including some that needed additional effects work. So there's an element of Jim Cameron's Aliens in that particular production. And as it happened, the Aliens Special Collector's Edition has been reproduced again and again. I personally was given a copy on VHS by one of my customers at my comic shop, which surprised me, and I was rather grateful for. It was very cool to get to see all that extra material. And I think that it was replicated in the DVD release that I picked up on its own. And then a few years later, I picked up the, I think by the time I bought it, it was a tetralogy, but I might have had the unfortunately titled Aliens Quadrilogy instead. Point being is I've got it on Blu-ray and all this material's in there now, so this is a familiar version to me. But at the time that this comic book was produced, very few people had a Laserdisc. It was very much a niche thing. Only your hardcore cinephiles tended to have it. And so for those fans, this two-book edition was probably the only opportunity they were going to have in that time period to experience this redacted material from a favorite film.
I'll be down in maintenance, okay?
Al!
What?
Hey, Al!
What?
Remember you sent some wildcatters out of the middle of nowhere last week, out past the Ilium range?
Yeah, what?
Well, one of them's on the horn, our mom and pop survey team. He says he's on something, wants to know if his claim will be on it.
Why wouldn't his claim be on it?
Well, because you sent them out to that particular middle of nowhere on company orders, maybe? I don't know.
Christ. Some hunch in a cushy office on Earth says go look at a grid reference. We look. They don't say why, and I don't ask. I don't ask because it takes 2 weeks to get an answer out here, and the answer is always don't ask.
So what do I tell this guy?
Tell him as far as I'm concerned, if he finds something, it is his. Lidecker?
What? Your kids know you're not supposed to be on this level. Go on, get out of here.
There's a little bit of additional dialogue in the comic book edition. Dad says, look at this fat, juicy magnetic profile, and it's mine, all mine. His wife replies, half yours, dear. And then little Newt says, and half mine, too. Dad says, haha, I think I've got too many partners. Newt asks, Daddy, when are we going to go back to town? Dad says, just as soon as we're rich, honey. Newt says, you always say that. I want to go back and play. Newt's brother says, yeah, you want to go back so that you can cheat at playing Monster Maze. Well, we're not going to let you play anymore. And Newt says, I do not cheat.
You too. You go in places we can't fit.
So, that's why I'm the best.
Knock it off. I catch either of you playing in the air ducts again, I'll tan your hides.
Mom, all the kids...
Hey, wait,
don't
wait a minute.
Care.
Come on, have a look at this, will you?
Folks, we have scored big this time.
Sure.
Let's see if we can't get a closer look at this thing. Maybe through that crack down the side.
Shouldn't we call in?
Let's wait till we know what to call it in as.
It's about as close as we can get.
Should we take a look inside?
Right back.
Okay. Bye.
after the parents leave in the comic book, Newt and her brother get into a little fight about her being a cheater. There's a notation that several hours pass.
Timmy, you've been gone a long time.
It'll be okay, Newt. Dad knows what he's doing.
Newt is, of course, screaming at the side of her father with a face hugger. In another sequence that I don't know to be in the screenplay and definitely isn't on film, I don't think it's ever been photographed, we have the notation that at Hadley's Hope, 25 hours later, Newt's brother is asking if she's coming or not. The little redhead boy refers to the brother as Tim. The short version is that Tim and this little redheaded punk are going to go through the air ducts to find their dad. Apparently, they've heard that the face hugger has fallen off of him and he's okay, but they're still not letting him out of court. Quarantine. Newt's hesitant. She doesn't want to get in trouble with mom, but ultimately she still wants to see her dad, and they all go through the air ducts. This is a sequence that really shows off some of the weirdness in Jim Somerville's artwork. Everybody has this sort of elven quality to them with weird proportions. Reminds me of people like Barry Blair or Wendy Penny, but of course they were intentionally drawing people weird. The adults look like little people, more Danny DeVito small than Billy Barty small. Let's say everybody looks like they're about 5'2", men and women. 4'11", somewhere in there, thin. And then you got the kids that look like they're about 2 feet tall, but their bodies are too elongated at the same time. It's just very peculiar. But I will say that the rendering technique is nice. It has a darkness. It very much feels like a horror comic, maybe like something DC would have done in the 70s. There's a little bit of Bernie Wrights in there, which is always nice, but you definitely have that strong element of caricature as well. This isn't realistic art, nor is it intended to be. It's supposed to be somewhat moody, and it seems to be kind of kids skewing in dimension, but clearly not in tone. So eventually the trio of kids get to the air vent looking down on the medical area. We see the kid's mom, Annie, arguing for the release of her husband. The doctor's bearded and semi-ginger, so maybe he's the dad of the little punk kid. They're talking about how they sent some men to check out the site to see if they can learn anything about the face huggers. Both the parents are irate about other men going to the site of their claim. Dad's drawn weird where he looks like he's really muscular for the most part, but he's got a pot belly. Just depends on what angle it reappears, disappears. Just as some of the men come back from the claim site with their own face hugger, the dad starts saying, "Help me," and before long, he's got a chest burster coming out of him. There's another sequence that's badly hurt by the artwork because this is the second time that we've seen one of the characters sticking their tongue out in a very juvenile fashion. And it's one thing when it's a little boy, which makes sense. When it's the dad as the chest burster is coming out of him, it takes what should be a moment of horror and turns it into an odd comedic beat. The chest burster itself is also heavily rendered in a sort of imagey style. It's a little bit reminiscent of Del Chione, in fact. And so it looks kind of cool, but it's also articulated in a way and rendered in such a way that there is a sort of comedic quality to that as well. Maybe not comedy, but definitely a cartoonishness to it. It does make me wonder, though, now that they've seen a chest burster, why they didn't immediately decide to go ahead and blow away the face huggers, despite it would have necessarily killed the host. But knowing that some creature like this is going to kill the host anyway, they don't have a reason to hesitate the way that the crew of the Nostromo did. And especially you've got the proposition of more of these aliens running around. I don't think they would want that. So it's a little odd they don't take precautions. We have a page of the mother trying to console Newt, and then a group of colonists are guided by armed men to a safe sub-level storage area where they're hoping that they can secure themselves against the aliens, who apparently that's by this point have reproduced enough to really start doing some damage. There's a black man who's talking to the mom and points out that they just have to hold out until the Marines come, and they're all very reassured to hear that the Marines are coming. There's another ginger guy, I don't know what it is with gingers at this colony, named Bill Andrews, who talks with the mom some more, explains that the nest is over at the atmosphere station, sets up what's going on within the colony. There's also a sequence where the armed colonists try to go after the hive, and just as what will happen with colonial Marines soon, the colonists are wiped out on video while the horrified survivors watch. If you thought the Marines were doing badly, imagine being a colonist with handguns and plain shotguns going up against xenomorph warriors. Eventually, the mom asks for a gun, and one of the other people are saying, we really want to have somebody who isn't trained with a gun running around with one? And mom basically explains that this is a Frank Darabont miss kind of situation where she didn't want the gun to shoot an alien. She wants a gun to shoot her family should it come to that. There's another instance of it seeming like the aliens are about to get into the fortified area, and they're sort of like, how can they be in the room? but there's also just a big idiot moment where I believe it's the same black fellow that was talking to the mom earlier insists on them opening their doors to let the survivors of the massacre in. There's only one man and he isn't surviving, and then they're completely overrun with alien warriors. Things get rather gory. Mom pulls the gun. Tim's crying and then points out that, hey, we can still get out through the air ducts. Mom grabs the kids and goes to throw them into the duct. He's going to try to follow them, but she's grabbed by a warrior. Tim, being a little idiot, jumps out of the air duct to grab the gun that she's dropped. She's already been bleeding all over the place. Tim fires at the alien. The alien blood comes down, hits him on the face. He burns, and then another warrior picks him up and chomps on him, apparently. One thing that is a little odd about the sequence is just how lethal the aliens are. I realize they're coming up against armed resistance, but you're going to want to have incubation hosts, so them killing the mom and Timmy, it doesn't make a ton of sense aside from the need to scar Newt and to, I guess, reflect continuity later on in the movie, but it's not really the process that's been established by the other alien movies. Newt's the sole survivor, seemingly. She goes running through the air ducts. She finally finds herself in a place small enough where the aliens can't fit. She's crying and talking about how her mom promised she'd never leave her. Obviously, that didn't turn out. And there's a two-page spread of Newt surviving over the course of several days. She also at one point goes back to where that final massacre took place and where she had lost her doll, and just recovers the head and starts covering that around. So again, continuity. You'd think in a book called Newt's Tale that we would probably spend a little bit more time with her surviving under these circumstances, but instead it goes right into where the character is introduced in the Aliens movie. This is around page 33 of 47 pages.
So they go inside. They start very, very careful, and then they start hearing like some noises.
And I think the motion detector picks her up as well.
Yeah. So they finally find a little girl, probably like, what, 8 years old?
Yeah.
Or like very...
The apparent sole survivor of Hadley's Hope.
Yeah. So she is actually living in this quarter, like in this room, in this ventilation that is just full of trash, it's full of toys, full of like old stuff that she can be able to scatter, you know, throughout the whole base. And at first, of course, she doesn't trust nobody because she's been living with this aliens for so long. How long was it since that, like, they got attacked at the base?
I want to say it was just under a month, if I recall correctly.
So she's been living for a month, like, with the parents dead, with everybody dead. She's living alone in that place, and knowing that they have those monsters, those aliens, losing around, which she doesn't understand because she's a little girl. So, of course, she doesn't trust nobody. Ripley is the only one who can actually make her to approach and to get near her for it to kind of...
Essentially becomes a mother figure to her.
She feels that comfortable, like, okay, well, she's to be trusted, so she can approach her. Were they together right around that scene or after that scene when the aliens started attacking, or they actually took her to the...
What occurs is the majority of the Colonial Marines are going into a part of the base to investigate the aliens, while Ripley, Newt, and Lieutenant Gorman stay inside a troop transport at a distance, monitoring through video feed.
What is the name of the robot? Because they do bring the... robot, just like in the first movie, right? They have like the first...
Bishop is the artificial human, yeah.
Ripley doesn't trust him at all, so you see that conflict on the Aliens movie, on the second movie.
And it's important to note that the character of Bishop is barely in the comic book adaptation. That's an element of the story that's almost completely set aside, mostly because a lot of the scenes in which he's interacting with Ripley take place before they reach the planet, and also Bishop and Newt don't have very many scenes together. And since the comic book adaptation is being pulled from Newt's perspective, she's present in the troop transport. She's watching the video, so she's seeing the Colonial Marines getting massacred by the aliens once they come out in force. But it's a little weird because the way it's portrayed in the comic book is you're seeing it through the video monitors, or you're seeing it first person among the Colonial Marines, where you would think that it would continue to be from Newt's perspective, since the comic is supposed to be about Newt's perspective. It basically starts to pick up as a direct adaptation of the movie at this point. Once the majority of the Colonial Marines are killed or taken captive to be impregnated with the alien eggs, the Colonial Marines are on the run because they call for the dropship to come pick them up after they've been dropped off at Hadley's Hope. Unfortunately, it had taken an alien with them, and so that ship is destroyed when it tries to return to the planet. Although, they also cut the scenes where you see the alien get on the ship, since we never saw the Colonial Marines arrive.
Okay.
Yeah, so in the comic, we don't see the ship come down, because that's not Newt's perspective. We only see after the alien has already contaminated the dropship and killed the pilot, and the ship crashes, because we're only seeing it from Newt's perspective, which means there's a lot of information that is never filled in as a result of that.
So,
a curious take.
Pharaoh, do you copy? Standing by.
Prep for dust off. We're going to need immediate evac.
Roger. On our way.
I say we take off, nuke the site from orbit. It's the only way to be sure.
Sorry, Newt.
You don't have to be sorry. It wasn't your fault. We better get back, because it'll be dark soon, and they mostly come at night. Mostly.
I mean, do you think that the comic is more interesting than the actual movie? Because to me...
No.
To me, it seems like it's missing so much stuff.
It is.
Like, it's just me, like, just seeing it through the point of view of a little girl when she doesn't understand, and just seeing, like, this, you know, very narrow point of view. That is just... How long is it, like, how big is the book?
It's 2 48-page editions, as I recall. So it would be the equivalent to a 4-issue miniseries where they don't tell you, like, the first third of the story of the movie.
So that pretty much, like, the whole comic is them running with the girl and the girl trying to tell them, like, how to escape based on the routes that she's taking.
Sort of, yeah.
And that's it?
Well, there's also...
Is there any connection with the characters besides Ripley?
No, absolutely not. So that's one of the things that's very frustrating about the comic book is, since it's focused on Newt's perspective, you do get to see Newt involved with the planning of how to barricade themselves against the aliens. You see her and Ripley bonding, in particular Ripley sleeping with Newt after Ripley had confronted Carter Burke because she was aware that he was the reason why the colonists went to check out the side of the alien ship and therefore brought the alien infestation into Hadley's Hope. And so she threatened to nail him to the wall. Therefore, Carter released the facehuggers into the room where Ripley and Newt were sleeping. So you see the whole sequence where she's defending Newt from the facehuggers. They set the fire to turn on the sprinklers that attracts the Colonial Marines, and specifically Hicks and Hudson come in and kill the facehuggers and save the women. And then, of course, once they're confronting Carter Burke about his attempted impregnation of the two females, that's when the alien assault really gets going and they break through the barricades and it's them on the run for most of the rest of
but
that.
But now, let me ask you this. On the movie, did they actually have a man saver, savior?
That's the case in the movie, because you have to understand, Carter had stolen the pulse rifle that Ripley had been given, although we don't see that sequence in the comic book either. So there's no bonding between Hicks and Ripley either. I don't even know if we know that the gun is missing. I don't think they show her trying to find the gun. A child and an unarmed woman against two facehuggers that can take down full-grown adults easily. They have to have somebody come and rescue them, essentially, because they don't have a way of permanently halting the attack of the facehuggers, and just there's not enough physical strength in the room to take two on. Ripley's barely holding her own against one, which I think it should be noted, though, in the movies, to my recollection, maybe the later movies they do something, I don't recall anybody else but Ripley ever fending off a facehugger. They all just, the facehugger attacks and they go down. So it is a testament to Ripley's strength that she is able to actually fight with a facehugger. I don't think that ever happens anywhere else, but because of that, their extraordinary capabilities with facehuggers, they do have to have the two male Colonial Marines come in and break through the door, or actually they break through a window and shoot the facehuggers.
Okay, so it's not technically a too much of like, oh, my savior, you're coming to save me. But which, when you were explaining it in the comics, that sounded...
It's a little bit more like that in the comic books. Like, oh, yeah. My savior, because they don't have all the setup that you had in the movie.
See, and that's what I like the movie, because it gives to that female strength. It's like, we're talking about Vasquez, and we're talking about Ripley, so, yeah. And then now the girl, and it's like, you still have an 8-year-old girl, but it's still fucking badass for surviving all those times alone, and knowing the way out of the whole thing, and she's actually saving this whole people.
Right, but she does still get lost in the turbine fine, although I don't think they explained why she was there in the first place.
In the comics?
Or maybe in the comic. In the comic. She is taken, and Ripley still has to go in there and save her. One major difference is that Ripley runs into Carter Burke after he'd been taken by the aliens, and he was cocooned and impregnated. So you see him feeling the alien moving around inside of him and knowing that he's about to die and asking Ripley to help him, and her basically saying, look, I don't have time to help you. She gives him a grenade. He walks off, and later on it explodes, so he does eventually kill himself through the grenade. That explosion is heard in the theatrical version of the movie, but in no version of the movie that I'm aware of ever being released into the public do we see that sequence actually incorporated into the movie. So Carter just appears to disappear.
Now, when you said the director's cut, that's the one that it was in Europe, right? Because it was two different releases.
I think you're thinking of Dawn of the Dead, where they did that.
Another favorite movie of Frank.
Yeah, of course. Essentially, James Cameron directed a lot of sequences that he really wanted in the film, but 20th Century Fox had a specific runtime they wanted to shoot for, and they did not include that material. So when the directors came out, they reincorporated that material. But for a period of time there, they were still floating around as deleted scenes, and not all the material that was filmed and deleted was put back into the director's cut. I personally like the director's cut, but it's actually one of the reasons why Alien stopped being one of my favorite movies, because it does make the movie a lot longer, and I do think that it weighs down the pace. It's such a propulsive movie in the theatrical cut that all that extra stuff bogs it down. And what's funny about the comic book is it seems to be built around including the deleted scenes. A lot of the stuff where we're seeing Newt before the alien infestation is taken from deleted scenes as well, and I just don't feel that it's necessary. But what's really weird is probably the single most important deleted scene in Aliens is a sequence where we learn that Ripley had a daughter, and because she was in such an extended hyperspace sleep of 57 years, this daughter that she'd left behind grew up, had kids of her own, and had since died. And so she essentially lost her daughter, even though her daughter had a full life before she passed. It really explains why Ripley bonds so strongly with this child that she just met. And we're also aware that Newt had just lost a mother, and actually her entire family, and so there's a real strong reason why that bond occurs the way that it does. And by removing that deleted scene, it hurts the narrative of the story. That's the one deleted scene that really needs to be in the movie. And for some reason, this comic adaptation that seems to be partially built out of including deleted scenes, they don't feature that sequence because it takes place without Newt present, so it's not in there either. It's a very frustrating adaptation. And what's also strange is, since they're essentially adapting the last two-thirds, you've got sequences like where Vasquez and Gorman are in the air ducts and they get overtaken by the aliens, but Newt wouldn't have seen that because she'd have been moving forward, progressing without them. We've never really been properly introduced to those characters anyway, so it's sort of like, why are we seeing this sequence if the conceit is it's supposed to be from Newt's perspective? So it's a very odd adaptation.
Well, it seems like the comics is not any good anyway.
This particular adaptation in the comics?
Well, yeah, this comic. Wait, there's like a different comic?
For this episode, we're only talking about the comic book adaptation, quasi-adaptation of the Aliens movie.
Okay, Aliens, okay. Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's just, it doesn't seem to be that...
It's very incomplete. And if you're going to do a story that's supposed to be Newt's tale, then don't go off with all these other characters that we haven't been properly introduced with in the last...
Do they have like a spin-off? Like, you know, with the perspective of Ripley or the perspective of Vasquez?
Nope. Just the one.
Well, that kind of seems dumb.
It's pretty dumb, yes, actually.
I mean, because it's just so narrow. Narrow on every direction.
Well, and what's peculiar is it's narrow, but it makes sense in the earlier chapters of the comic because that's literally the story from Newt's perspective. And so it's giving you the story of what happened on Hadley's Hope. But then you lose Newt halfway through the book and it just becomes an adaptation of Aliens. So you've created this conceit, but you're not following through on it, and then you're just doing an adaptation of Aliens. It seems very pointless and misguided, and you lose all the emotional connections. You don't have any character introductions. Short-sighted. Shallow. I wish they'd just done a straight adaptation.
So what is the main... Okay, well, first of all, the main question that... I thought that the movie was based on the comic, or is the comic based on the movie?
The comic is based on the movie.
Why would you do that?
Right. I'll tell you what I think is the probable purpose. As mentioned, the last act of the movie is Ripley saving Newt from being impregnated with an alien, escaping from the planet before a nuclear reactor explodes and destroys everything. They get back to the Sulaco, the ship that they're on. The alien queen has managed to come back with them. She spears the synthetic human Bishop, even though, again, we have not been introduced to him for the most part. part. He's had almost nothing to do, but him getting stabbed is supposed to be impactful, supposedly. And then you have Ripley fighting the alien queen with the power loader before she gets rid of the alien queen. But again, so little of this has been set up.
I thought it was actually, okay, well, it started as a comic, just Walking Dead or many other things that is being based on a comic and it's made in a movie, and the movie created this extra stuff. And it's based on a book? No, right? It's actually...
It's an original screenplay. Books have been written in the Aliens universe. Comic books, 30 years worth of comic books were produced within the Aliens universe, but it's originally a movie screenplay. Everything comes from the movies.
So almost everybody loves the second movie. You know, yeah, the first one is good.
Well, it's a very contentious debate within the fan communities. People prefer Alien or Aliens.
Okay, well,
but there's a general consensus they're both good movies. Yeah.
Alien or Aliens. Yeah. Nobody cares. I mean, there's not that many people caring about the Alien 3, Alien 4.
And I love Alien 3 personally.
Yeah, I mean, you're weird. One of the most important movies and one of the best, most regarded movies about this franchise is Aliens. And then you created this comic book just with this very narrow perspective where it's like, oh, if I read that comic, I'll be like, why am I wasting my time on this? I just prefer to go watch the movie, but which is giving me more story, for which is giving me more of everything instead of just me wasting my money and time with this little
and you sort of bring up the reason for it. The Alien comic book adaptation was one of the best-selling comic book series ever.
That's because the people just like the movie so much that they just wanted, it's like Star Wars, they would just want
to
buy.
To some degree, but also it was an extremely well-guarded adaptation by name creators.
Even this one, the Aliens.
No, the first Alien.
Oh, the first Alien.
There was no Aliens comics produced at the time that the movie came out. The publisher Dark Horse began publishing Aliens comic books 2 years after... Aliens comic books 2 years after the movie came out.
So when you say Aliens comic books, it's just the little sections of new
stories. No, the Aliens comic books start telling new stories set after the second movie.
Oh, after the second movie.
Now, one of the problems with those comics is it's set roughly, let's say, 10 years after Aliens, and it tells a story of near adult or late teenage Newt and Private Hicks because they weren't allowed to use the character of Ripley. And because of the events of Alien 3, those characters should not have been available to tell those particular stories. And because the Dark Horse Aliens comics were built around those two characters, they basically had to go in there and retcon their own stories to feature different characters. And so before the release of Alien 3, they did their adaptation of the movie Aliens, which has a bookend sequence from beginning to the end that sets up what happens in Alien 3. Really, they're not even trying to adapt Aliens. They're explaining what actually happened with Newt, since what they had told people for the previous several years what happened to Newt couldn't have happened based on what happened in Alien 3.
Okay.
That seems to be the only reason why that comic book existed.
Okay.
And you're talking about it coming out like years too late, multiple years after the Aliens movie.
If the purpose of that comic is not to recreate what happened in the movie and to recreate that
even
story,
though that's exactly what they did for the second half.
No. Yeah. What I'm saying is that if that story was just for a means to continue what later on was going to happen with Newt, this is just like a prequel based on the actual movie, then I can accept the reason why. And not just because, oh, Aliens is a pretty cool movie, but I'm going to come out with this comic book that is just about this one little girl's perspective. That's BS for me.
Well, if it serves a purpose for
the other ones, then okay, I can see that.
In the opening part of the book, that is interesting and it is a valid choice. They just don't stick with that choice, unfortunately. It makes for a very frustrating and unfulfilling comic book.
Well, because you like the movie, so you are frustrated about the limitations.
No, I think even if you take it, because I mean, part of the point of this...
Well, just imagine that you actually haven't seen the movie.
Yeah, it still wouldn't make a lot of sense. You lose Newt for a good chunk of the book, and she's supposed to be the protagonist from her perspective.
Who is showing when she's lost in the...
It becomes Ripley's story. Oh. So yeah, it doesn't really work. One thing I do have to say about the comic book that's very frustrating is that they don't have likeness rights. So all the Colonial Marines look alike. They all are brown-haired guys. I don't know why they couldn't at least replicate the uniforms. They do give Bishop bushy eyebrows, make him a little more wily looking to differentiate a little bit, but could definitely use some more. And the fact is there's not a lot of Bishop in this comic anyway, so it's sort of moot to have him be distinguished when Hudson and Hicks are not. There's also this weird thing that Jim Somerville does where he has the aliens drop down from places and they've got one of their legs fully extended in front of their face. Again, very cartoonish, and
weirdly, given that it's comic book art, you can really lean into how the xenomorphs are different from humanity. But because he draws them with fairly humanoid proportions, they look more like guys in suits in the comic book than they do in the movie. And see, by the second chapter, they're going full on adaptation. They're getting most of the key lines, key sequences, but it's very rote. Characters are not elaborated on. Circumstances are not elaborated upon. I really question what anybody would get out of this if they hadn't already seen the movie. There's just too much left unsaid. This is the third episode of the Dark Horse Presents Aliens podcast, and it's the first one to actually cover Dark Horse's presentation of Aliens. And I kind of wanted to have those first two episodes be like 0A, 0B for me. To a large degree, this feels like the first true episode, because the goal of the show is to discuss Aliens and the continuity that was built out by Dark Horse. Most specifically focus on just the comic books. I rewatched most of the Aliens movies, at least the tetralogy, in 2016 in preparation for going to Comicpalooza and meeting the cast and presenting them artwork and that sort of thing. I've not seen the movies since then. I've seen none of the Alien movies since 2016, and I made a point of not watching it before this podcast because I want this podcast to be about the comic books, and I want to see how the comic books work on their own. But I did go to look up some of the best Aliens comic books per the internet. Comic Book Resources did a top 15 list of Aliens comics. Newt's Tale landed at number 8, and having read it, I'm really confident that the people who were writing this list did not do what I did, because if you look at this as the adaptation of either the best Aliens movie or the second best Aliens movie, because I don't know of anybody who doesn't think either Alien or Aliens are the best lot, then yes, of course, you would rate Newt's Tale as number 8, since this is the only authorized English language, professionally produced adaptation of the movie Aliens. However, if you read it as a comic book, it doesn't make a ton of sense. There's tons of material that's essential that's left out. You do not connect with any of the characters, really, with the exception of Newt. Given how extraordinary the movie is, the comic book just does not live up to that, and there's no way that I would rate this as a top Alien story, since it doesn't work very well as a story. It doesn't work as an adaptation. It doesn't work as an original story. It doesn't stay true to its set premise from which the title is derived. It's a bit of a hot mess. The artwork is good at times, or it's nice, it's attractive. I've definitely seen worse looking Aliens comics, but you've got the wonky proportions, you've got some wonky takes. The unintended comedy hurts the horror and the sci-fi elements. And I remember passing on this comic book back in 92. This was at a time where I was actually having previews catalogs. I could have pre-ordered these books, but I couldn't bring myself to spend $5 in 1992 money on a two-book adaptation of a movie, given the sordid history of comic book movie adaptations. And this is so much less than the Archie Goodwin, Walt Simonson Alien adaptation. Pales so much by comparison that it really doesn't deserve to be compared. It's not even really up to the quality of some of your lesser DC and Marvel movie adaptations, much less one of the most revered to have ever been produced. It's a bit of an embarrassment, to be frank. And while the art has its issues, it really comes down to trying to make a miniseries out of mostly deleted scenes that just don't form a story, and then giving up on that and deciding to do a straight up adaptation with the first third of the movie missing. It's ridiculous and it's incompetent, and I could not recommend this comic book. It's frankly disrespectful to compare this adaptation to the majority of the Dark Horse comics, which are produced in good faith and with the intention of telling a quality story. This feels like a cash grab to a large degree, and I think it's an unfortunate book.
Get away from her, you bitch!
I spent 3 hours trying to get a clean version of the sound effect of the computer type during the inquest into the destruction of the Nostromo, where Ripley is being debriefed by Weyland-Yutani executives. I went so far as to dig out the Aliens anthology, go through some of the special features, and find where they actually offer the full details of that burn-in effect from the movie. Unfortunately, they played theme music over the sound effect, and so once I got the recording down. I couldn't isolate the sound effect. In fact, in that particular version, I could almost hear nothing but the music. Over the course of attempting to get this done, I also smashed to pieces the external Blu-ray drive that I had that never worked properly anyway. So just understand, a lot went into the social media, despite it ultimately ending up being a robot polar bear reading out your names and your messages.
Stand by 5,000, like Dark Horse presents Alien, the Illustrated Story, 1979 post. Mike Nascimento's commented on same, as well as sent an email stating, "Hey Frank, love this episode. If you're looking for a copy of 1941, Rick Veitch has copies for sale on his website." And Skeletor tweeted, "Fun thing is, I got my copy as a digest-sized extra of the 40th anniversary Blu-ray release." Eric Freitas wrote, "Saving this for later." Sysboy wrote, "Been listening to your Aliens coverage and really enjoying the digressions. Now this sounds like the way your comments read." Another historical link to Alien is the Doctor Who serial, The Ark in Space. Not only is the plot close to that of Alien, but really Scott may or may not have almost been assigned as production designer on the serial before he left the BBC, depending on the source. Might be worth investigating. The truth of it is that the only documentation we have is that Scott was originally assigned to The Daleks, the second ever serial, before it was reassigned to Regnan Cusick. Similarities between Alien and 1975's The Ark in Space, Cryosleep, and Alien Invasion Body, the claustrophobic space set, was surely down to the script rather than the direction. But there were almost too many of them for this to be just a case of standard sci-fi tropes. But inspirational credit has never been given. I was a latecomer and not much of an adopter of Alien's comics. I think my first was Hive, though technically the tail end of some strips in Dark Horse Presents probably. I can't be sure without opening some boxes and checking publishing dates. Still, the fact that you're making it about licensed comics in general as well makes it all the more interesting.
Future guest Derek W. Z. wrote, "Cool Alien episode. I had read the Walt Simonson adaptation, but like you, came to the adaptation way later in my adult life. Glad to hear your take on Lily Cat. Socially distant official Alda and Sonny Perkuntite Baby Skeletor, Krista Ford, Chris Lyon, Clownfish, Bill Dracula, Doc Strange, Eric Reed, Excuse Me, Max, Fat Host Podcast, Federico Divergillis, Green Lantern, H. Keith, The Hammer Strike, Geeky Stuff, and Voice Ever, History of Comics on Phil, Iowa, Joe Crawford, Iron Cobra, Jeffrey Brown, Jay Slash Dan, Coil Dubin, P.G. Baker, King Dinosaur, King Size Comics, Giant Size Fun Podcast, Louis Scarlet, Blue Check on the Night, Earth Destruction Directive, Michael Wagner, Mike has sent aliens to me, Monitor Earth, Ryan Paydaw, Bozzy BWP, Ralph Lovick, Rub Raymond Salvador, Ryan Belly Zink, Filibuster Should Be a Candy Bar, Siskoid, Stimbot 5000, Tristan Narrows.
By the way, I'm keeping a running list of requests to co-host for specific Aliens miniseries. Derek put in for a bunch of them, so it's probably a good idea to stake your claim now rather than later. The person who asks for one specific story gets preference, and of those, I'll tend to defer to the one that asks first. Derek, for instance, has locked down the 1989 miniseries as his primary choice. So long as everything goes as planned, the next show will cover the Space Marines mini-comics, but I'm waiting on my copy of the Aliens Omnibus that's already been delayed twice from April to May and now June. That might prompt a production delay or substitution, since I don't have copies of the mini comics, and this will be my first time reading them.
This has been a Roald Spine podcast. All audio samples are believed covered under fair use laws. No copyright infringement is intended.
Aliens, sponsored by Sears, where you get your money's worth and a whole lot more.